Hey everybody, my name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm going to be moderating today's webinar discussing the release of the CFPB's proposed debt collection rule. By my count, it's been about 54 hours now. We're almost at 54 hours since the proposed rule was released. So if you read at a rate of about 10 pages per hour, you probably just finished going through the 538-page document that they released on Tuesday. Tuesday. There's a lot of ground to cover, and I know everyone wants to hear from the panelists and not me, so I'm going to get through my introductory remarks today as quickly as possible. This webinar is being generously sponsored by PDC Flow. You get the chance to hear about them a little later in our program. I want to take a quick minute and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ERM industry. I publish unique and curated content, maintain a number of email newsletters, host webinars like this, and offer a bunch of different podcasts for the ERM industry. The site's free for everyone to use, and it's a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I just had someone tell me yesterday they call it tuition-free education, so I really like the sound of that. I hope everyone will spend a few minutes checking out what it has to offer every day. Let me tell you now a little bit about today's speakers. Roseanne Anderson is the Chief Compliance Officer for Ontario Systems. Responsible for driving the company's consumer financial law compliance program, designing innovative compliance solutions for Ontario and compliance outsourcing programs. Her 2 decades of experience in the ERM industry make her one of the most respected experts in the credit and collection industry. John Bedard is a nationally recognized authority on the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act and the Fair Credit Reporting Act. He serves as counsel to several professional trade associations, including the Georgia Collectors Association. He's a former member of the board of directors of the industry's leading professional trade organization, ACA International. He serves as the state of Georgia compliance chairperson for ACA International. As a former chairperson and program designation award recipient of ACA International's member attorney program. Joanne Needleman is the leader of the Consumer Financial Services Regulatory and Compliance Group at Clark Hill. She is a past president of the Board of Directors of the National Creditors Bar Association and also served on the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's Consumer Advisory Board. The format for today's webinar will be a panel discussion. We encourage everybody to submit questions and we'll get to as many of them as we can. We do have an incredibly large audience registered and so far signed on for today's webinar. So if we get a lot of questions, we might not get to all of them, but we'll do our best. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is being recorded, and a recording will be made available probably by tomorrow morning on AccountsRecovery.net and its webinar recordings page. Finally, I want to ask everyone to take a minute and fill out the feedback survey that should pop up on your screen when today's webinar is over. You'll also receive a link via email tomorrow to access the survey. Participation in the survey helps me develop content that's what you're looking for and find the speakers you want to hear from. So with that, let's launch into our discussion. So panel, like I said, we're 54 hours out. Any initial thoughts that you want to start with based on what you've read and evaluated within the proposed rules so far? Roseanne, do you want to get started?
Sure. Thank you, Mike. Some of my initial thoughts, I think I know my co-panelists will agree that the one thing we're seeing within the industry is fundamental confusion about the concept of a regulation. And what I mean by that is that I think we've taken for granted, and many of us, especially in the legal community, have talked about the new rules, the new proposed rules. When we say rules, we know rules mean regulation, which means an interpretation of an existing law. When people who are trying to run a business on a day-to-day basis hear that, they may not realize that this is not an amendment to the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. This is, under the authority of Congress, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's interpretation, which we must abide by, their interpretation of how to further comply with the FDCPA. So that really will cover, a lot of the commentary that people will hear today and going forward, and that they have to understand if you comply with these regulations, like the letter of the regulation, you are in fact, I'll leave Joanne and John to disagree, but for all practical purposes, if you comply with the reg, you're going to be meeting the expectations of the FDCPA. Fellow panel, comments or assistance on that one to help people understand?
This is Joanne Needleman. First of all, I just want to say how fortunate I am to be on this call with John and Roseanne. I always get great wisdom from both of them. Roseanne, you actually kind of hit one of the things that I was going to talk about. You're so right. And to let me take it one step further. Not only is this an interpretation of the FDCPA, this is not a repeal of the FDCPA. I get the sense from a lot of the opposition that we have heard that for some reason the FDCPA is getting repealed. It's not. The FDCPA is still alive and well. It could be a lot better, as we all know, but the letter of the law is still there. And so I think we all have to keep reminding ourselves of that.
Mike, this is John. Thank you for having me today. And, you know, of course, I'm going to, you know, agree with Roseanne and Joanne. But I think this proposal now is going to introduce our industry to a lot of new things. We're going to be introduced to some new vocabulary. We're going to be introduced to some new concepts. We're going to have to adapt now to what we know is going to be a very large step forward in the advancement of the application of the FDCPA in the arms space, which is precisely what the industry has been asking for. And so we are now being given some potential tools that we can use to advance the way this industry operates by decades. And so I think both consumers and the industry can and should embrace that. It's not going to be easy. This is very, very dense material. If anybody's taken a look at it yet, it has been the result of a lot of time and effort and thought, not the least of which money that the government has spent to create this very comprehensive document that they've given us. And so, you know, we're not all going to get it all right on day three or day two or 50 hours. It's going to take months and months and months to really digest and get our arms around all this. And I know Roseanne said it at the beginning and Joanne hinted at it. We all need to have an understanding that this is not the rule today. These are proposals, and there's going to be an entire process by which this proposal gets commented on by everybody, consumers and industry alike, and then it's going to go through another government process of rewriting. And so this is not the law today. It is what the government proposes the law might be in the future. And so what I've been telling folks is don't panic. We have time.
He's right.
John, you cracked me up.
Does that mean we don't have to have any more of this webinar? We can just all kind of hang out and relax?
No, not at all. That wasn't the message I was conveying there. I hope that's not what came across.
No. I was just taking it to an extreme.
I have a couple.
Everybody, hold you. Go ahead, Roseanne.
Well, I was just going to say, hopefully I'm picking up what John was saying about we do have time. We all exposed to new vocabulary. People who know me, I hope you just take this with a grain of salt. I'm not like chastising anyone, but if you haven't figured out what e-sign means yet, now is the time to write down that word e-sign. It doesn't mean reg, and it doesn't mean email. E-sign is referenced a number of times in a very positive way, I believe, for our industry. But we need to get our heads around what e-sign means, both under the Electronic Signatures and Global Commerce Act, and then as used in this statute. Also, John talked a little bit about vocabulary. People, you know, I do gap assessments, Joanne and John do as well, and often people just kind of muddle their way through the questions. So do you know when the validation notice period expires? And there is a million ways to answer that question, except now, under these proposed rules, there's really no question of when the validation notice period expires. It is, for a reminder, it's 30 days after the consumer receives the validation information. Plus, they've given us 5 days. I want John to comment on those 5 days, but it's not just 5 calendar days. Also, they've codified overshadowing. Don't confuse people. Now it's part of the regulation. No longer is it going to be, gee, I wonder what we should do to, what information should we put in the validation notice? Well, it's pretty well set forth in this regulation. So those are just a very hot couple of points I just wanted to make, that vocabulary is meaningful. Understanding what the words mean is your first step towards understanding how this impacts your business.
Excellent. Well, we're off to a great start. At this point, I just want to pause the discussion for a moment and say a few words about the sponsor of today's webinar, PDC Flow. PDC Flow's payment hub offers a single platform for accounts receivable teams to quickly send an invoice, collect a credit, debit, or ACH payment, and obtain the signature in one simple and secure workflow. The software offers text, email, chat, and IVR payment channels, a customizable online payment portal, and robust reporting ideal for debt collection agencies, medical billing companies, hospitals, and healthcare organizations. Programming and customer operations for PDC Flow's national client base have been completed in-house in Ogden, Utah, since the company's founding in 2003. Thanks to Don, Hannah, and the team at PDC Flow for sponsoring today's webinar. Really appreciate their support. Now let's pick up with our discussion. Obviously, as we said, this is going to take weeks and months and who knows how long to sort of fully digest, fully get our arms around, and whatever other metaphor I can think of before I move on to my next point. But based on your initial reading, your initial analysis, is there anything in the what in the proposed rule surprised you most, John?
Well, you know, the thing that for me that was most surprising when I first received my copy was how much thought, how much consideration, how very, very deliberate each of these sections is in the proposal. I really didn't know what to expect before these came out. I thought we were going to get some kind of FODI fix and it would be easy, just say this. Well, not quite. It's not quite like that. I thought maybe we would just get a model of a validation notice saying, if you use this, then you comply with the statute. But no, we've got very, very detailed information about what the validation notice is, and now this new term about validation information. And so what surprised me most was the breadth and the depth at which this proposal actually goes to bring some clarity to a lot of the things that industry and consumers have been requesting. I was also quite surprised that the proposal addresses many of the asks that were made of the CFPB. Yep. You know, I frankly would not have anticipated these proposals to have addressed as many things as it addressed. But you know, industry asked for technology, we got it. Industry asked for a FODI fix, they got it. Industry asked for a model disclosure, they got it. Industry asked for meaningful involvement comment, we got it. You know, so it's like all of these things I didn't really expect to be included, but it does address them to varying degrees, some better, some not. But nonetheless, if I had to characterize my initial reaction to it, that's, I think, what surprised me the most.
This is Joanne. I echo all of that. I was very, it was great to see and appreciated the effort that the CFPB made in trying to incorporate technology and new ways to communicate. I think that was the biggest, we have been talking about this since the FTC roundtables back in the early 2000s, that, you know, the name of the game is communication. And I think to John's point, these are very deliberate proposals, but you can kind of see, not that the CFPB struggled, but the efforts that they've made to try to figure out what is the best way that we can start this communication process and keep the communication process going while at the same time ensuring there's consumer protection. And I was really relieved to see the effort that was made. Again, to John's point, industry asked for technology. It wasn't so much technology. It's the ability to communicate. it has become absolutely difficult to reach out and communicate with consumers. And I think we can all agree on this call, the only way to resolve for any kind of debt resolution is communication. And now, thankfully, we have all kinds of ways we can do that. So if we can figure out what that scheme is going to be with appropriate guardrails, I think it's a benefit to everybody.
I do too. And this is Roseanne. And I'd just like to say that people should probably appreciate the fact that the CFPB has recognized the role that creditors play in the debt collection process, as well as the role prior debt collectors play in the debt collection process. And to that end, I think many...
Hello?
Uh-oh. Joanne?
Did we lose Roseanne?
I think we might have lost Roseanne.
All right, let me jump in, Mike. You know, Joanne, and I think, Joanne, to your point, one of the things that I really appreciated about the rules or these proposals was the balance that the CFPB struck when it comes to the communication. Yes, we have all these communication channels. Yes, we have these contact caps. Yes, we have all these things. But the balance that the Bureau gave consumers was the unconditional power to control the communication channels and the unconditional power to stop the communication process in its tracks. And so, you know, I think it's important to keep in mind that despite all of the green lights the industry has been given, the Bureau proposes to give consumers the unconditional control of the red light.
John, I would agree with you. However, if anybody saw the town hall yesterday, I don't think that the consumer side sees it that way. I hope that...
Well, they hadn't gotten done reading the whole thing. Hadn't read the whole thing yet.
I understand their concerns. We have to appreciate their concerns. I certainly hope that we can use this comment period, even beyond the comment period, to forge some sort of understanding about the concerns that they have and the ability that the CFPB is trying to achieve through a balance. I do see these rules as balance. Now, you know, industry does. Obviously, consumer advocates don't. But I really hope that we can forge some sort of common ground, because at the end of the day, and I think even consumer advocates would agree, it is about communicating. And however we strike that, I hope we can get there in some way, shape, or form. I certainly think that this rule is a great starting point.
I do too, and sorry about the interruption. I also wanted to just mention before we move on, Mike, is that there's been a case that a lot of us have been following kind of with bated breath about, it's Wobbly versus Med One. And that was kind of a case, almost a case of first impression about, can you include a URL link, you know, a hyperlink to a debt collection notice, to the validation notice in particular, or not? What level of proof do we have that we sent it, that it was open, that it was read, et cetera? And the rules really, what surprised me is they no longer are we waiting for that court's decision with regard to these proposed rules. They basically have embraced the use of hyperlinks in various contexts, albeit subject to very stringent requirements, but nonetheless, it's recognizing our ability to move past snail mail into the electronic delivery of information to consumers on their terms, as Joanne and John have explained. And I think that is extremely refreshing. And they didn't go so far as to create a mailbox rule equivalent for electronic delivery, but they went pretty darn close in the sense that they said, if you are going to send this information, for example, electronically, you should expect your providers to monitor whether the mail electronic delivery was successful, and if not, you can't assume that it was delivered. You know, some basic, they really are touching on some of those requirements.
Yep.
We've gotten a couple of questions about this, and we've kind of touched on it a little bit, but maybe it makes sense to just spend a minute talking about sort of what it means to be a proposed rule, what the process is now that, you know, sort of the comment period and sort of what's going to follow that, and maybe sort of hint at a possible timeline for when we're going to see or may see an actual final rule. Joanne, would you mind sort of walking us through that?
Sure. So first of all, we still have more than 90 days because the comment period does not trigger until these proposed rules are published on the Federal Register. And I've been checking every day, and so far I haven't seen it. So my guess is they'll probably get published early next week. Once they are published, the 90-day clock triggers. And industry, anybody can comment, which is, you know, you respond to how you feel about the rules. If you are reading and poring through the rule itself and what the CFPB has put out, there's actually very pointed questions and certain content that the CFPB is looking for. I've highlighted that in a special color when I go through this, so I know I'm not missing anything. And then so you have 90 days, and then after that 90 days, the comment period closes. The CFPB then will spend probably 9 months to a year pouring through these comments. You will recall when we did the AMPR back in 2013, they got 23,000 comments, so they poured through that. So it's going to take some time. After they go through the comments, they will then issue a final rule, which is going to be very similar to this, but it's final. And there will be a comment period for that. And then there will also be an effective date, which will usually be a year from when the final rules are promulgated. So I think we talked in the last webinar, you know, you're not going to get a final rule of which industry will be required to comply with probably not till 2021. Sorry for the bad news, but that's what it is.
So more fuel on John Bedard's "Don't Panic" fire.
Right. But as we've said before, and we can't stress enough, certainly associations and coalitions of groups will be filing comments, and as they should. And if you're involved in any of those groups, whatever they may be, please give them your thoughts and tell them your position. Make sure that there's some sort of consensus. But I encourage everybody, I don't care who you are, if whatever you do touches this industry, submit a comment. If there's something aspect that you don't like or you feel needs to be addressed, send in a comment. You like the rules, you don't like the rules, whatever the case may be, please comment.
Good advice. Let's take a minute and try and tackle a number of the questions that have come in from the audience. And again, obviously, you know, based on your reading so far, if you haven't gotten that far, I'm not sure, we can just move on. But in your opinion, does the proposed rule require that a consumer consent prior to receiving emails? Does anyone have any thoughts on that?
Well, it's kind of a yes and no.
As we all furiously look through through our copies.
Well,
it's a yes and no.
Well, yeah. How about this? Let me try it this way. The answer is yes. However, consent can be demonstrated in several different ways. One of those ways could be if the consumer sends the debt collector an email. The proposal suggests that when the consumer sends the debt collector an email, that is an indication of the consumer's willingness and consent to communicate by email. Now, those email rules have a bunch of other things, you know, hoops that you're going to jump through. And so generally speaking, the answer is yes, but that consent can be demonstrated, you know, a few different ways, which is why Roseanne mentioned e-sign earlier, because e-sign is also one of those ways.
Another point of clarification when people ask that question, and as you read through the rules yourselves, the question, does the consumer need to consent to email? Well, these new rules proposed rules draw a very bright line between opportunities you have as a third-party debt collector to provide validation information and required legal disclosures electronically, and the hoops you need to jump through to do that versus communicating, I'll say it this way, John, you said you were going to call me back today. You know, some email that's more conversational. So I think people, we're going to now see a separation where your one set of rules kicks off if the question is, what kind of consent, what level of consent do we need from a consumer to consider sending them validation information within 5 days of our initial communication, as our initial communication in an electronic form? You know, there are going to be all these nuances to it. And it's hard. I think the reason all of us paused is because we've all got spreadsheets and charts that are with arrows going every direction, because it is still a little difficult to explain. It won't be impossible, but it's challenging to explain. If the creditor already complied with eSign, but even though they didn't actually use the e-rely on it, can the debt collector rely on that? Or only the fact that, does consent transfer, but does eSign consent transfer not? It's all very confusing. I don't know how else. John or Joanne?
Yeah, I think you're right, Roseanne. And I think there are two tracks that we have to look at. As you said, there's the whole issue of delivering disclosures electronically. And there's a whole regime that's involved with that. And then there's the I'll call it the subsequent communication. And you have to look at that. And, in trying to piece this together, and that's really what you have to do. It seems to me that if you look at some of the sections, and I was just looking at this before we got on the webinar, the CFPB has given industry a bona fide, a definition of bona fide error when you're communicating an email and text, and if you make a mistake. So, they want to be very clear. They want to make sure that when we're using these technologies, we're getting the same person. So they're requiring debt collectors to have these various policies and procedures in place. So it would indicate to me, and part of that has to do with consent and how you got the email address. So it seems to me, do you need consent? Yes, but I think operationally, why wouldn't you get it? Because it really then goes and helps in your bona fide error. It helps to keep your policies and procedures neat and clean so that you know that the email and text is the text that you are using are the right ones. So consent is going to be, and knowledge of that information is going to be a big part of that.
You know what else is really cool?
Yep, go ahead, Roseanne.
About the new rule, though, is this has always plagued me because of all the work we're doing on text messaging and emailing, et cetera, is what responsibilities does a debt collector have with when you send a consumer an email and it appears on the face of their iPhone or their iPad or laptop, and they're in the close proximity to someone else? Is that an unauthorized third-party disclosure? My initial reading of this is it's not. So long as you the proper steps before you launch that communication electronically, we need not worry that it may be viewable by someone sitting next to the consumer?
Yes, Roseanne. In fact, there's a passage in the proposal that talks about the over-the-shoulder disclosure. And the position the Bureau takes is that consumers are in the best position to avoid over-the-shoulder disclosure. And so they thought that there wasn't a need to propose a rule regulating that because consumers are exclusively in control of that kind of thing.
And I think that's great. I don't know about the consumer groups, but I think it's great.
Yeah.
On the flip side, Not maybe on the flip side, but they also have additional requirements that I think the language is that when you provide those communications, they must be readable on any commercially available screen size or some language similar to that. And so the technology exists today, but we have to be sensitive to the notion that, you know, sometimes I get emails with attachments or whatever, and, you know, it looks like the writing is microscopic. I can't read it, you know, for some reason. Maybe I'm using it incorrectly. But when industry begins to use this technology, I think the general notion here is that we need to be sensitive to the ways in which consumers will be consuming our communications, and they need to be reasonably viewable by whatever device the consumer is reading it on.
Including a screen reader.
Yes, yes, that, which is ADA language, right?
That's ADA language, yep, that is.
Excellent. Okay, the questions are flying in now, so let's see if we have another one. The proposed rules talk about 4 itemization dates. This person has a concern they did not include a date of default. A promissory note, signature note, or similar instrument would not have a charge-off date, but the date of default balance would be higher than the balance based on last payment. Last statement not usually provided for transaction date. Does anyone have any thoughts on how to address this with the CFPB?
I'll answer that question.
Sure.
As we all know, because we were all involved, John and I were involved in Sabrifa, the initial Sabrifa proposal was to just use the default date. And industry overwhelmingly rejected that. All associations, because default date is not defined in the statute. I should say it's just, you know, default date can mean a lot of things to a lot of people. And so the proposals overwhelmingly were charge off date, last statement date, some of the things that the Bureau has explained. I think it's going to be interesting to have to now go back to the Bureau and say we want a default date when we've rejected it. In fact, if you look at the comments, they said in the Sabrifa panel that there was, you know, overwhelming rejection of default date. So,
and I think you're right, and I think that by giving us 4 options, that's right, actually, right. I think they're being quite open-minded.
Generous
term
and generous, yeah,
generous.
Yep.
And the other thing I think we have to a bias I have is that somebody won't give it to you is I think that's kind of dead in the water. Because these new rules are revolutionary to the process by which people collect debt on behalf of the person who won't give you the information. So
correct.
I don't think they're going to suffer fools. I think that if you need the last statement date, you're going to have to get the last statement date, you know, or the debt is almost insufficient for the marketplace.
Correct.
I think it's a good thing. I think it creates a level playing field, and I don't consider this I think we can fix this one.
Absolutely.
Joanne, to your point, this itemization date concept, which I think we add to our new vocabulary moving forward now for the collection space, this itemization date, I think, was in direct response to the Sabrifa and the comments that industry gave the Bureau about the difficulty of a default date.
Absolutely.
And I think the Bureau understood, and the Bureau recognized that default date is not a solution. And so this is the Bureau's attempt to reach the result without hamstringing consumers and industry with this nebulous default date.
John, you and I sat next to each other for 8 hours. That was a big topic. That was a big, big topic. Yep.
A couple of questions have come in asking about any possible connection between the proposed rule and the TCPA. For example, do you see a conflict between the opt-out texting proposal of the proposed rule and TCPA rules regarding opt-in and prior express consent for text messages?
It's a good question. It's a very good question.
Now, wait a minute. The TCPA doesn't require it requires you express consent, number one. And number two, right. Conflict I see is that the proposed rules discuss call caps. And I think there's a phrase, place a call or attempt to call, of course, is a phrase. But I see confusion in that the right arm, meaning the CFPB, may not have had recent conversations with the FCC, where the FCC and a lot of judicial courts have held a text to call. So I'm hoping that once we go through this final rendition, that the CFPB will clarify if it literally means placing a call, and then God bless them through whatever that means, because it doesn't mean rotary phone. It doesn't, it could be, there are many different ways to consider placing a phone these days, to your computer, et cetera. I think that for me, the big disconnect is what is a call? And hopefully that'll be clarified, because right now I think it's vague. And if you have to cap calls, do cap calls that we think of like what a human and a human will talk, or a text to a text?
Hey, Roseanne, I just want to say you're breaking up sometimes, so I don't know whether you're on a headset or not, just so you know.
Oh, thank you. No, I did not know that. Thank you. When did that start?
Industry needs to think about, I think that was a really great question, and there's going to have to be a lot of thought about that. There's also going to be, now that we're entering into the email text world, there's a whole other set of regimes that we need to think about. And if you're not familiar with CTIA and what that association is and how they regulate text messaging, you're going to need to start getting familiar with that, because I think there are some inconsistencies. I don't want to blow up and start going off track, but I just want to point out that, as you know, while we embrace technology, we want to incorporate it into our operations, there are other regimes we need to think about. And you need to think about also, internet service providers. We have to think about how you're going to do your unsubscribe. There's all kinds of requirements about that. There's also concerns, if internet providers see a real uptick in traffic to a particular email address, or there's a domain address, and they also can block. So I think we've got to look at all of that carefully, should these rules become final, and should we be able to start using technologies. There are some roadblocks that we're going to have, and some hurdles that we're going to have to go through.
Okay. Further, sort of staying on this the topic. The proposed rule proposes treating text as not a call, while the FCC says text messages are a call. Does anyone have any comment on that discrepancy and what might possibly be problems down the road?
Forgive me for being ignorant here. This is John. It was not apparent to me that there was a conflict in the law between those things. I mean, the concept of a call under the TCPA is a totally different sort of interpretation regime than the concept of a call under the FDCPA. It was not apparent to me that those things are in immediate conflict. And as we were having this discussion, I went back to look, and the call frequency limitation, it does not use the word call unmodified. It does modify it with telephone. So it's a telephone call that is restricted, not just call. And so, I would have to give that some more thought to find the real conflict there. We just have to be careful in terms of making sure we have consent under the TCPA to send text messages to cellular telephones, while at the same time having FDCPA consent to provide disclosures electronically. I think those two things can coexist. I just haven't really thought through the potential for conflict there.
I agree.
Okay. A bunch of questions have come in related to the call caps that were proposed in the proposed rule, seven call attempts during the course of the week, one conversation, and then collectors are supposed to wait, but there are exceptions to that. Does anyone want to sort of walk through the call caps provisions in the proposed rule?
Sure.
Or did I just do it?
you just did it.
there's a lot of nuance there. The basic proposal is what you said. I mean, that's the basic proposal. The exceptions are if the consumer says you can call me back, or there's some sort of consent, or there's, quote, express permission from the court. I know there's a lot of concern in the legal debt collection world, once you file suit, sometimes you need to call the consumer a couple times, maybe to do a stipulation, maybe to say that there's been a continuance. Is that the express permission of the court? I don't know. So we may need to get some clarification on that. But I think that the proposal is pretty straightforward. Now, as we know, while there's a seven telephone call limit, there's unlimited contact, within the parameters of the FDCPA. I want to be clear about that, and the director was very clear about that yesterday as well. You can email more than seven times in a week. But keep in mind, you can't be harassing and, can't be doing other things that the FDCPA prohibits.
There's also an exclusion from, it does not count towards your call cap limit if the call did not connect to a dialed telephone number. So for example, a triple tone. You get a triple tone, that doesn't count as one of your seven. The staff interpretation or the official commentary even talks about a busy signal not connecting to the phone, but a ringing but unanswered telephone does count towards your call caps.
Correct. That is correct.
The thing that remains restrictive is there is no indication in the rule that if you are ringing the phone number of a wrong party, and so you might not know it, but you're calling a phone number that does not belong to the consumer, and that phone is not answered, but it does ring. Even though it ultimately ends up being to the wrong party, you may learn later, that seems to count towards, well, put it this way, there's no exclusion for that call not counting towards your seven. Now, I guess what I don't know the answer to, which is probably you're going to get 1,000 questions now, Mike, is what if the collector makes a telephone call and a person who is not the consumer answers the phone? Does that count towards the limit?
That is addressed in the limit.
You call and a spouse answers?
Or no, you just got the total wrong number.
The wrong number. I
just got. Yeah.
I think it does count towards? That is addressed in the limited content section. It's not addressed in the call, necessarily the call cap section, or at least I haven't seen it yet.
To a particular person. By placing a telephone call to a particular person in connection with the collection of a particular debt more than seven times. So,
right.
So maybe that opens the door for that wrong party not counting towards the seven, because we're not going to call the wrong party more than one time, much less seven. I don't know the answer to that. I guess I'm asking questions that I can't even answer myself.
Right. It says a particular person in collection with a particular debt. I got to go look at
I think that's worth underscoring now. I apologize if it's a bad connection. But
Nope, you're good
now. Okay, good. Particular person is helpful because when Director Craninger announced the new proposed rules, she spoke repeatedly in terms of per consumer, and it caused a lot of angst for a lot of people if call caps were going to be basically not per consumer, if it was not per debt per consumer, if it was just per consumer in total, then you would really be in a conundrum if you represent five different creditors, for example. How do you manage communications about all five debts? But now it's particular person, unless it's a, what did they say? They explained with regard to student loan debt, the call caps correct. Would apply to a particular debt, and for student loans, if the debts, if let's say several student loan accounts were assigned under the same parent number, so the same account number, then together they would be counted as one debt. So there's a question for multiple student loan debts. If they're assigned to you for collection under a single number, single account, then you have to treat that as a particular debt when looking at the call caps.
John, your question's answered on page 507, which is the official interpretation of section 10.06.14, and it says misdirected calls. If within a particular 7 consecutive days, a debt collector attempts to communicate with a particular person by placing telephone calls to a particular telephone number, and the debt collector learns that the telephone number is not that person's number, calls that the debt collector made to that number are not considered to have been called to that person during the 7-day period.
Outstanding. See that?
Okay.
507 and 508.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
All right. Some questions have also come in about another provision in the proposed rule, related to the validation notice. One question, with the new notice requirements, are there any suggestions or thoughts on how an agency would apply their required state language in a validation notice?
They talk about that. I have to get to the spot. There's a specific discussion about that.
With regard, do they do it with regard to the model form, Joanne? Because I don't know.
Off the top of my head, I don't remember. They did talk about it. I have to find it. They did talk about that. They talked about that potentially, possibly in a link, mm-hmm. if you were doing electronic disclosure. As far as the paper disclosure, I've got a. You know, I read it. I don't know when I read it, I believe that it's addressed. Whoever that person is, we're happy to get back to them and let them know what page number we can find that on.
Sure. Okay. Anything else with respect to the model validation notice that any of you want to address or bring up or mention before we move on?
You know. Look, as all of us are, we are thrilled that we've got a form, and the proposal is clear that if you use the form, it's a safe harbor, and you would be, you know, complying with the FDCPA. Note that the form does not follow the statutory language, which I think is interesting. Not really.
Which is going to put the Third Circuit into orbit.
Right, right. Oh, you know what? I'm sorry. The person who asked about the state disclosures, I'm looking at the model form and it says right there, review state law disclosures on reverse side if applicable. And the comment was that if you have additional disclosures, you must note that in the form that it's attached or it's on the reverse side. You've got to put that on the front part of the form. So I hope that answers your question. Getting back to what I was saying before, yeah, you know, and what's interesting, there is no mini Miranda on here. So it's interesting.
I didn't even notice that. Does it really not include?
That seems like an oversight, doesn't it? Because in the text of the rule, it does require that is one of the things to be included.
Yeah, it's not on the form. That's not to say that you would put it, but it's not on, it's not on Appendix B.
Right.
It's not on Appendix B. But again, you know, we have, you know, we want to comply. We want to follow what the Bureau is proposing. But there's nothing really in here that says, you know, this is an attempt to collect the debt. Any information obtained will be used, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, your 30-day dispute rights, although it does say if you want to dispute the debt. But the form itself does not have all the you know, the magical words that we have used for so many years.
But let's discuss that a little bit. To my way of thinking, once an agency like the CFPB, others have done it many times in other contexts, produce a model form, the whole idea is that if you use the model form, it's considered a safe harbor.
Correct.
To me, I mean, maybe the courts will view it differently. I don't know. What would they say? The CFPB was wrong and hold in favor of the plaintiff? I don't know. I mean, to me, a model form is a model form. Like Reg Z, well, model form.
The model's on page 491 for everybody's benefit.
Yep.
The thing that struck me about the model is that it imposes a tear-off and it absolutely does not comply with font and text size requirements that states impose on letters. And it also makes me very, very sensitive to how we're going to fit all the state disclosures that we need to put on the letter, notwithstanding that there will be a reference on the front to the back, which is not new to industry today. And so those are some of the things that struck me about the notice. The itemization, we're going to have to, I really, really like the idea that the itemization needs to include interest, fees, and other charges, and whether, you know, how much you've paid toward, credited towards it. And there's specific reference in the proposal that if you identify interest or fees and indicate that those amounts are zero, you are not misleading the consumer,
and it
does not violate the statute to identify interest and fees in an amount that is zero. There's been a lot of litigation over that, and this will clarify that is not misleading.
Right. You got your Avila fix. You got your FODI fix and your Avila fix.
And they did have, they do put the Miranda warning, though, in the top section. They just...
Yeah, it's there.
It's reworded.
Mm-hmm.
North-South Group is a debt collector. We are trying to collect the debt that you owe Bank of Rockville. Mm-hmm. We'll use any information you give us to help us collect the debt.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's so to what Director Craninger was talking about yesterday, sort of more plain English conversational. A question about the disclosures. What about the fact that some of the states require their notice to be on the front of the initial demand? Any ideas on how to reconcile that?
At this juncture for me...
Well, instead of using...
No, no, I just feel at this juncture, I hesitate to say how to reconcile some of the state conflicts.
Yeah. Maybe we don't send 8.5 by 11 sheets of paper anymore. Maybe the sheets of paper we send are 20 by 30.
I think that's what they do in New York now, if I'm not mistaken.
I also wonder if they're thinking that we are moving more to an electronic environment. That these concepts of space and 8.5 by 11 begin
don't really
to
matter anymore.
You know, I wonder.
It was interesting. I'll just point out real quickly. It was discussed yesterday. If some of you remember during the SREFA process, there was also a statement of rights that has been eliminated, and that was an issue for the consumer advocates yesterday. That has been eliminated. So.
Well, here's the thing, though.
But no, go ahead, John.
Has it been eliminated, or have consumers been? Is there a different way for consumers to receive it? Because what we notice here on the form is a specific invitation to go visit the CFPB's website, and
well,
so I suspect.
Well, I would say yes and no to that, John. First of all, you certainly do not have to include that in your initial demand letter, so that's eliminated. They're just at this point saying go to consumerfinance.gov. I go to consumerfinance.gov all the time. It's a very in-depth website. Just going to consumerfinance.gov does not give you a statement of, you're not going right to the statement of rights page.
You're right.
Also, let's not confuse. That leans in the reg itself. It states if you're collecting a consumer financial product or service as defined in 106.2F, they seem to be making some delineation between some certain kinds of debts and the ability to refer them to that particular website. I think before we close, though, Mike, I do think we should have one of the panelists at least comment on the some really good news about the hopefully good issuance of advisory opinions. I know John feels passionately about that, if you'd like to.
Yes.
Well, you know, one of the things that you had asked us to be prepared for is, you know, what do we like? One of the things that we're happiest to see included in this proposal. And if I had to pick one, I think it would be the Bureau's willingness to issue future advisory opinions. The Bureau, it seems to be, inviting advisory opinions. And the thought that this industry might be able to send questions to the Bureau and have the Bureau answer some of our most difficult questions in the future is something that we have not had since the FTC stopped doing that decades ago. And so if there's one great thing I would point out in here is this notion that the government is going to be willing again to entertain some of the most difficult questions facing not just the industry, but even consumers, and give us clarity along the way, so that in 2040, we're all not clamoring for, new rules on a decrepit old statute again.
There's a question here, and it's something we touched on a little bit before with respect to the opinion of consumer advocates, and something I've noted in some of the coverage I've dedicated to the release of the proposed rule, mainstream media as well, in terms of how they're covering the release of the proposed rule. And it seems to me, and a couple of people have asked questions about it, that there is a potential battle in terms of the comments that are going to be filed. So the question that came in was, what can the industry do to help educate everybody, and especially the CFPB, so that the barrage of consumer comments to the rule don't end up changing it for the worse.
This is Joanne. As we had said before, it's really important that industry, that everybody submit comments. I would also say that as an industry, we need to remain vigilant. Now that while you may like some of these rules, have some questions about them, I think overall industry has been very supportive about the rules. Again, these are proposals. These are not the final rules. I think we have to keep our guard up. I think clearly from the media and from what I heard yesterday, the advocates are not happy at all. I don't know whether this has been politicized or not. My guess is it probably has been. But we cannot sit on our hands just because we think we got a good rule and that this is going to continue on for the next couple years. Advocates could conceivably tie this rule up for years until they get a more favorable director. So please keep that in mind.
Well, did you predict 2021, even in your original comment? That's kind of made me shudder to think.
Till there's a quote, final rule that's implemented, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, final rule, if the effective date is 21, I can, that's one thing, but if this pass moves through another election cycle, it could be at risk.
Absolutely. In general. Absolutely.
One thing that we were saying recently, there was a group of us to get together as part of an innovation council hosted through Inside Arm, and a lot of us were talking about what Joanne brought up is the need to be vigilant, send in comments. Our industry, for the most part, and I know why, each company and each owner, each individual employee, there's always been a reluctance to send in a comment because you don't really want to be waving a flag. There's just this kind of an understandable attitude about just staying under the radar about when it comes to these sorts of things. Conversely, every citizen and their brother send in comments. So they get thousands upon thousands upon thousands of comments, and they read these. Now, and they also, of course, get the associations on our side. They'll get the trade association commentary. But I really do think that, and what I'm hoping the trade associations will do, will give people a type of template letter that they can sign and really put their name to it when it comes to certain issues regarding these proposed rules. Because I don't think... You know, four comments from the major trade associations compared to, you know, God knows how many on the consumer side will work in our favor. I think we have to hear from the people who are touched by these rules, even on the industry side. That's my personal opinion.
You're absolutely right, Roseanne. And you make it even a more important point. I know I've been saying everybody's got a comment. There needs to be consistency of comments, too. I mean, everybody, their voice needs to be heard to be effective. To be effective, we all have to be saying the same thing in some way. Mm-hmm. I mean, everyone will have an opinion. You're entitled to that. But mm-hmm. I think associations, if we can give us an outline of the talking points that certainly should be stated, everybody's got to use those talking points when they're coming.
Well, we're past the hour mark, but I don't want to wrap up too quickly yet. What I'd like to do is go around the panel and give each of you a chance to offer any takeaways, parting words of wisdom, anything you didn't get a chance to address, but felt that it was important enough that you wanted, you know, to take a chance to share before we wrap up, because I'm sure this is the first of what will be a series of in-depth articles and webinars and podcasts and coverage that I'm going to be dedicating to this, but at least so far, if you don't mind sharing any summary. Roseanne, would you mind going first?
Certainly, that's fine. I think, it's hard to, I don't really want to get into the weeds all of a sudden at the closure of the webinar, but what I do want to suggest is that visit the CFPB's website. They are posting with a fair amount of frequency tools to help you navigate the proposed rules. They have flow charts. They have summary charts. It's a really good resource. So don't be a stranger to the CFPB's website. As for that, I think Joanne's opening comments about let's try to bite this off in pieces. We can't digest it all at once. I know myself, I'm working very hard on a spreadsheet myself with regard to e-sign consent. When it applies, how it applies, etc. So I think people just have to take some time to study. Oh, I know what I was going to say. Assign a task force in your agency. If you haven't done it already, no one person in your organization can truly be responsible to digest all of this and effectively communicate it. They need peers. That's what I would say. It'll help.
Awesome. Excellent. Thank you. Joanne, you're up.
Still digesting. I thank everybody for getting on the call. I know we didn't answer everybody's questions, and we certainly didn't drill down specifically about each section. There's 11 or 12 sections here that the Bureau has put forth. We're still digesting. I would recommend, if you are really reading this and looking at it, and if you've been assigned to at your agency or company to look at it, look at the rule, but I would also tell you the official, the section-by-section analysis and the official interpretation are extremely insightful. I've picked up a lot of interesting nuggets from that. There's a lot of clarity in that, and not only how the Bureau arrived at its proposal, But, you know, the what if questions that we all keep asking, a lot of that, and we found one today in the middle of the webinar. So that is really helpful. I would also suggest, while we talk about a 500-page rule, note that in the beginning, where they just talk about the whole process, there was a lot of research done by the Bureau, and a lot of reports that now have become public. If you get an opportunity, you need to look at those. And I know all the trade associations will be doing that, because that is in support of why there's 7 call caps, why they're doing email. Those will be important as we start to go through the comments. So take a look at those as well.
Well said, thank you. John?
Thank you, Mike. There are very few times in our businesses and in our industry in which we really have an opportunity to shape the law. Now is one of those times. I encourage folks to learn something about what the Bureau is proposing. You don't even have to learn all of it. Learn something about it and make a comment to the Bureau on whether or not that is good for you, it's not good for you, or anything else you want to comment on. We don't often get an opportunity to shape the trajectory of the law like we do now. And what happens now has the potential to be the law for many, many years. And so if there's one thing we can do now is to recognize the opportunity that we have. And I don't mean just the trade groups, like you heard Roseanne say a moment ago and Joanne say a moment ago. This is everybody from our frontline collectors to our middle management, to our directors, to executives, to owners, and the vendors and service providers of all those people, because they are an important part of this industry as well. Learn something about this proposal and make a comment on it.
Excellent. Good advice. Well, Roseanne, John, Joanne, thank you so much for your time and your insights today. You guys, 2 days after the rule release, citing specific pages and the ability to answer most of those questions with pretty comprehensive answers. That was awesome. Thank you so much. You guys were excellent. Also want to thank PDC Flow for sponsoring today's webinar. Please go to www.pdcflow.com to learn more about the company. Thanks to everybody who participated, who asked questions. I hope we got to them. We tried to get to them, as many of them as we could. If there's any questions we didn't get to that you want to get answered, please feel free to email me, and I'll do my best to help out. The recording of this event will be posted to accountsrecovery.net at some point tomorrow morning. And I think that's it. Well, excellent, guys. Thank you very much. We'll talk to everybody soon. Take care.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks, Joanne and Ron.
Thanks, Mike.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, guys.